Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming. If you can find a seat. As some of you will know, if you've been to our City Horizons event series before, this is our event series where we have speakers who take a longer view on what's going on in Britain's British cities, but also cities across the globe. We encourage our guest speaker, to think about that over the longer term. And we've got a fantastic guest to do precisely that this evening. Many of you will know who he is. It's Sir Richard Leese, who is the leader of Manchester City Council, has been the leader for 22 years, and also a councillor in Manchester for 34 years. He's also, as of last year, a deputy mayor for the economy of Greater Manchester and the combined authority there. You'll also know Sir Richard is a leading light in regards to the core cities and indeed the cities and devolution agenda more generally. So Richard's going to talk to us about what's been going on in Manchester over that period, over that last 3 to 4 decades, and some of the key elements and key milestones that tell us something about how Manchester, but I think also tells us about how other cities have evolved and adapted to quite significant changes that have happened to them over the last 3 to 4 decades. And then, as always, once Sir Richard is finished, we'll open it up for questions. So have a think about the questions that you want to ask Sir Richard, and then we'll conclude and we'll have a glass of wine and whatever else outside and carry on the conversation. So without further ado, Sir Richard, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Good evening, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here. If I was stuck in Manchester tonight, I'd be at the opening of Pep Guardiola's new restaurant with a Michelin two-star chef flown in from Catalonia, but I'm really pleased to be here. I'm planning to run through a pot of history of Manchester from 1979 to the present day. It will be a very selective history, and clearly it will be a very partial, in every sense of the world, history of Manchester at that period of time as well. 1979, to be more precise, I'm going to start on the 2nd of January 1979, which for those of you who remember, we had very heavy snows on the 2nd of January 1979. I think there are a few people in this audience that will not remember that. But that's the year I moved to Manchester. Manchester is an immigrant city. I'm an immigrant. I was born in Mansfield, brought up there. I went to university, actually, University of Warwick. Not here, obviously, but in its early days when it's still largely ploughed fields. And worked in Coventry for a number of years, moved to Manchester for work. I worked at the Abraham Moss Centre in North Manchester, in Crumpsall, on the edge of Cheetham Hill. Loved that area, loved the area. It was, even all those years ago, 39 years ago, it's an incredibly diverse area in the way that a lot of places weren't in those days. Incredibly lively, lots of vibrancy about Cheetham Hill. Very happy to live there, and I've lived in that part of Manchester for the last 39 years. I've moved a lot, but never more than a few hundred yards actually around that area. Can't say the same about central Manchester in 1979, and certainly when you get into the early 80s, the recession of the 80s, you really saw almost the destruction of a lot of what Manchester was and had been. East Manchester, one of the industrial heartlands of Greater Manchester, in a couple of years in the early 80s, 70,000 out of 110,000 manufacturing jobs just went and were replaced with nothing. And even now you will see large areas of open space in East Manchester, which is where factories used to be, which is where people used to work. The city centre itself basically closed at 5 o'clock. Monday to Friday, it was largely people working in offices. There was a city centre economy based around financial and other services. There was a retail centre. People went shopping on Saturdays, obviously not on Sundays in those days. But in terms of a night out, apart from a few restaurants in the few hotels that there were, Chinatown, a couple of Italian restaurants, there was not a lot to keep you in Manchester city centre in an evening, and not a lot of people stayed. And of course, if you did go, but by and large you had to drive, there was no other way of getting there. So that's the Manchester I'm starting with. If you go to Manchester now, a Manchester that would be very, very difficult to imagine. Even the Arndale Centre, once described as the biggest public convenience in Europe, the Arndale Centre, massive shopping centre, looks completely different now to the way it looked back in 1979. I was first elected to the council in 1984. I was very much an accidental politician. It was never something I aspired to, particularly wanted to be. I've always been an active trade unionist. I got involved in 79, early 80s, in anti-cuts campaigns. Not a lot changes, really, because we're still in the same position now. And that was my route from trade unions, anti-cuts campaigns into the Labour Party. And through that, that I started getting involved in politics and was approached around about 1983. Would you be interested in going on the panel of candidates? There's another bit that meant I had circumstances that allowed me to do that. So I went on the panel of candidates. So I got selected for the ward I lived in, which then had a Tory councillor. So there was no guarantee I was going to win an election. So I think of Tory councillors in Manchester now. We've not had one for over 20 years, and to be honest, I don't miss them a great deal. I won the seat and I became a councillor. So it's a very accidental route. There are other similarities with what's going on now. One of the attractions for me of joining the Labour Party was having a left-wing leader. In this case, it was Michael Foote, perhaps not the most effectual leader of a party ever, but certainly a politics that was very attractive to me at the time. And when I see the Labour Party now, with lots of idealistic young people joining the Labour Party to support Jeremy Corbyn, I say it very much reminds me of myself a long time ago. And actually, the fact that we've got lots of idealistic young people getting involved in politics, I think is a real positive, because they will be the future. They will, over time, become more pragmatic. They are the future. I'm going to take this in years, years that I think are significant years in the history of Manchester. Other people probably have different years, but if that's 84 and I've got elected, the next year I'm going to pick is 1987, because for me 1987, something happened that had a real long-term effect on the politics of Manchester. And what happened was that Labour lost the general election in 1987. Why was that significant? Well, with a left-wing administration in Manchester in 1984, where we did everything possible to avoid cuts, including a whole number of off-balance sheet funny accounting in order to avoid making cuts. Losing that general election basically meant we had run out of money. We'd hoped that Neil Kinnock was going to win the election, he was going to ride to our rescue, and everything will be all right. Well, it didn't happen. And following losing the general election in 1987, we did something else in 1987 that was fairly significant. To avoid cuts, we put the rates up by over 20%. The electorate noticed, and they weren't very happy about it, and we lost a lot of seats as a result of putting the rates up by over 20%. The following year, we were rate capped, and as we were rate capped, then the cuts that we were been trying to avoid for 4 years, we had to make. And if we were going to tackle deprivation, if we were going to tackle poverty within the city, it was quite clearly no longer going to be done through municipal socialism, which had been our dream for that period from 1984. recognise that if we're going to tackle poverty, that we have to tackle the causes of poverty, not just the symptoms. And there are many causes of poverty, but our city at that time, given that history, the biggest single cause was unemployment coupled with low skill, low wage employment. If we're going to tackle that, we had to create jobs. We were cutting jobs. The public sector was cutting jobs. The only way we were going to create jobs was by a new way of working with the private sector, because that's the only place that jobs were going to come from. Now, that debate took about 4 years, actually, to get through that debate, but it was 87 that triggered that debate, and was the start of really what municipal Manchester became and the approach that we've taken ever since. And there was no change in our objectives. What we were trying to do, just the recognition that if we're going to achieve those objectives, we had to do it in a completely different way. The next day, I think we might have some water. It's 1991, and in 1991 we had something called Hume City Challenge. Actually, it sort of started in 1990, and in 1990 we went to Michael Heseltine with a vision of how we could regenerate Hume. It's a neighbourhood immediately to the south of the city centre. At that point it was described as having some of the worst housing anywhere in Europe, never mind in this country. System-built housing, very shoddily built. Housing that within 18 months of being built was declared unfit for families. It's absolutely appalling, and we went with a vision. And it's still our belief that, that if we hadn't gone with that vision, that City Challenge would never have happened, because we were also, City Challenge was the answer to how we were going to set about delivering this vision for Hume. And Hume, over 5 years, myself, council colleagues, some of our private sector partners, particularly AMEC, Sarah Cockshaw was somebody who's a great aid to what we're trying to do at that time. A relatively senior, but not as senior as he became, officer called Howard Bernstein, started putting together a plan about how we were going to do a large-scale regeneration project, that we were not just going to physically transform an area, we were going to undertake a social transformation of that area as well. An area that had become completely depopulated and the population was going down, an area that should have had 15,000 people was down to about 5,000 people, how we were going to build that back. And by and large, everything that Manchester knows about regeneration, we learned in Hume over that 5 year period of time. Absolutely central to everything we did afterwards. And what did we learn? Well, first of all, that we learned for regeneration, you do it with communities, not to communities. And indeed, as we were replacing housing very rapidly, we got to a system not that you could leave the area and come back, you would have one move. You never had to leave the area at all, where people could see their new home being built down the road from their old home. But with communities, not to communities. We learnt about strategic planning. It's very commonplace now. It wasn't commonplace then. But we've actually learnt it from the United States. It didn't come from anywhere else within the UK. And it came from a Canadian master plan who introduced ideas for about how you do urban design that came from the United States. We learned to be being proud about being urban. We learned about density. We learned about the importance of design. We learned about having street patterns that were real streets that went to places. We learned about all of those things in terms of what we did in Hume. And started to make the case for urbanism that actually, if we want to have a sustainable future, it will be in dense urban areas that have good public transport links where people can walk to work. We started talking about mixed use in Hume. No developers would do mixed use. They didn't like it, they didn't understand it. But we insisted that we were going to have mixed use in Hume. It was going to be a mixed neighbourhood, that we would have jobs as well as places to live, as well as places to play. Similar time, in operating within the city centre, we had Central Manchester Development Corporation, a government agency, again established by Michael Heseltine, but one in Manchester that chose to work with the council, and the council chose to work with it. It didn't happen everywhere else. They largely adopted plans that predated the Development Corporation. They used the council's own planning department rather than establishing their own. That was the start of repopulating the city, that they took some of the old disused offices and warehouses around the city, Victorian warehouses, fantastic buildings, and started the conversion of those into apartments. Back in the mid-1980s, Wimpy had built an estate, St John's Gardens, now a very desirable estate. They couldn't sell them. Nobody wanted to live in the city centre. So selling that urban vision of cities being a good place to live was part of the task that we had to accomplish over that period of time. Elements of that were first the notion of a 24-hour city, certainly improving the nighttime economy. I said earlier we didn't have much of one, but improving the nighttime economy, that the cities were genuinely 24-hour places because people lived in them. Also improving the reasons why people wanted to be in the city centre. So it was that time we started building the Manchester Arena. Every city's got one now. They didn't. Manchester Arena opened in about 1993. We started building a new concert hall. We built a new concert hall, the Bridgewater Hall. Then once we got a decent concert hall, we found out how crap our orchestras were, because we could hear them properly for the first time. They are now very, very good, because we can hear them properly. One of the reasons that Halley is probably the best orchestra in this country, apart from the fact with Mark Elder it's got a really, really good principal conductor, is that they also have a good concert hall as well. It is a requisite for it. The art gallery was refurbished and extended. I think the extension of the art gallery, the need for it, was first recognised in 1892. It took over 100 years to deliver it, but we started doing it. We started basically putting in the amenities that made a city centre worth being in. We reformed our licensing procedures. Up until around about 1992, we had a rule that there was a fixed number of licences within the city centre. The only way you could get one was by buying one so that somebody had already got one. We loosened that up. We effectively deregulated licensing in many ways to create a city that increasingly that people wanted to be in. And also in that period, through City Pride, started taking a cross-boundary approach. City Pride, an initiative from John Gummer, the Secretary of State for the Environment at that time, three cities, London, Birmingham and Manchester, invited to put forward a prospectus. And in Manchester, as well as the city itself, it also included parts of Salford and Trafford within that prospectus. Trafford Park, the old the Keys, the old docks area, part of that. And out of that started to come part of an infrastructure, Midas, our inward investment agency, Marketing Manchester, our national and international marketing agency that had a footprint wide of the city itself. And indeed, Marketing Manchester, when it came into being, started off covering the whole of Greater Manchester, and with a very clear understanding that for international marketing, whichever part of Greater Manchester you were in, the brand was Manchester. And that did not take away from the identity of all the places, individual places that make up Manchester. And that meant, to get to the next date, 1996, when we've had the biggest explosion since the Second World War there has ever been in the UK. It's a £3,000 bomb. Blew up in the city centre. That was not, as some people have said, the making of Manchester. You can never describe a bomb as being a blessing in disguise. It's not. As a city, we were already in a position. We had the partnerships that have been developed through successive Olympic bids, through a successful Commonwealth Games bid. We had the understanding of how placemaking worked to be able to respond to that bomb very, very quickly. Responding quickly was absolutely essential. I only found out the theory about 20 years after we'd done something fairly instinctively, but it's relatively simple theory around how you recover from disasters. It's a fairly standard thing in a disaster to say we're going to build even better than it was before. Now, if you're going to build even better, you need more capital. What happens in a disaster is you lose capital. You lose it immediately. And if you're going to rebuild bigger and better, that one of the things you have to do is to staunch the outward flow of capital as quickly as you can possibly do. So the fact that we had, within 3 months of that bomb, where over 600 businesses were not able to operate, that we had every viable business operating within 3 months, again within the city centre, was the sorts of things that we had to do to staunch the flow of capital. That we ran an international competition and turned it into planning, supplementary planning guidance in around 10 months was again about staunching the flow of capital. It's giving people certainty about what the future was going to be and the frameworks they could operate within. And all of that allowed us to start reshaping the city centre, getting rid of some of the planning mistakes that were made in the 60s and 70s, having a far more permeable, far more walkable, far more livable city centres. That is really something that is demonstrable now. I can take you to bits of that master plan and just show very clearly how it made a difference in the way the city functions. One of the things that we learnt in Hume was also that this stuff takes a long time. That when we started Hume City Challenge, it was a 5-year programme. We sort of pretended to government we could do it in 5 years, but we always thought it was a 10-year programme anyway. When we started on East Manchester a decade later, we were very clear that was a 20-year programme, at least a 20-year programme. Hume, by the way, which is a real success, it is a real success. 27 years on, it is a real success. It is now full, people live there. It's not finished yet. 27 years later, it's not finished. Similar with our city centre master plan, we haven't finished that yet either. We're just about getting to the last bit now, which is something that's known affectionately as the Ramada block. It's horrible, that will hopefully be redeveloped in the next couple of years. And again, we will be doing effectively a new park in front of the cathedral over the next 12 months as well, which again is part of that 1996 master plan. I'm going to switch city for a minute. I'm going to switch to Sheffield. Sheffield in 1979, the first Core Cities Summit, a collection of the big cities out of London. A really important paper there. It came from the University of Newcastle, Kurz at the University of Newcastle. It reintroduced us to the notion of functional economic areas, and it made the case of city regions, not cities, city regions, as drivers of economic growth. It made the case that in order to function effectively in driving growth, that they needed devolved powers, and it made the case that devolved powers to the cities to drive the economic growth was absolutely essential to increase social inclusion. There was a connection between the economic agenda and the social agenda. Out of that, Core Cities spent pretty much the next decade making the case for cities and cities' role in driving growth. Making that case, and I'll return to this in a minute, was absolutely essential to where we've got now with combined authorities, with devolution packages and so on. But the starting point for that argument really was that paper that was being prepared for the Core Cities in 1979. I'm going to take something that fits chronologically but doesn't fit in the logic of the argument, but I'm going to take it chronologically rather than anything else, because it's an event that, again, was very important for what Manchester has become. It was something where, until it happened, the national press reported as what was going to be a major disaster for the city of Manchester, which was the 2002 Commonwealth Games. All the national press said we were completely incapable of hosting an event of this sort until it happened, and it was absolutely brilliant. When, of course, it was always going to be great at that point. It nearly was a disaster. there was very little government support for the Commonwealth Games. With 12 months to go, we didn't have a budget. So we had no way of running the Commonwealth Games, but we got there in the end. It was important for all sorts of reasons, and actually one of the reasons, it had an impact on London. London would never have got the Olympic Games if Manchester hadn't run a successful Commonwealth Games, because at that point, because of the abandoning of the World Athletics Championships that are supposed to be taking place in London, the stock of the UK in terms of hosting major events was absolutely rock bottom. And a successful Commonwealth Games gave a platform for which other things could take place within this country. It was important in the sense that although Greater Manchester had been functioning for a voluntary association ever since the demise of the Greater Manchester County Council, this was really the first time that people across Greater Manchester started to take an ownership of the city and believe that Manchester was their city. It had quite a psychological impact on the city region. And it's also important in terms of the legacy of the Commonwealth Games. Some of that is a physical legacy. And one of the rules we have for the Commonwealth Games is no white elephants. But you see the success of those sporting venues now. Probably the pinnacle of success is actually the Velodrome, which has probably produced more gold medal winners in the Olympic Games than any other sporting venue in the world, actually, through British cycling. Some of them we were a little bit lucky with in the long term, that for the stadium itself, if we didn't have a long-term tenant, we wanted to build a permanent stadium, it would have been a temporary stadium. Manchester City were our second choice, not our first choice. And I say that as a Manchester City season ticket holder, but they were our second choice. We could not have guessed what would have happened to Manchester City around about 6 or 7 years later, and the transformation they brought to East Manchester through their activity is there. There's also legacy in terms of the events programme. Manchester International Festival is a direct legacy of the Commonwealth Games in 2002. And there is a legacy in us developing a better understanding of what sort of city Manchester is. What are the characteristics of the Manchester brand? That we are a city that is open. It's open to people from anywhere who want to come and do stuff. It's a city, it's very much live and let live. We let people get on with things. And it's a city that has a little bit of attitude. Let's say a little bit of attitude. I'll tell you a story that's it's a Birmingham MP. Did some work with some young people in her constituency in Sedgefiston about and this is in Birmingham, it's done in Birmingham, it's reported in the Daily Telegraph, so it must be true. It's asking these young people to design a poster about what Manchester had that Birmingham didn't. And these young Brummies designed a poster for Manchester which basically said, if you don't like us, fuck off. but we recognise we've got a certain bit of attitude and a belief that we can do things. This is absolutely fundamental. Cities who believe they can do things, do things. You have to have that faith, you have to have that belief. And the Commonwealth Games was part of restoring Manchester's confidence in itself. That 1980s recession had knocked the confidence out of us, it knocked the stuffing out of us. The Commonwealth Games was part of restoring that confidence. I'm going to move on to 2006. 2006, a three-party delegation, two Labour leaders, one Conservative leader, now Baroness Williams, who's a government minister, and a Liberal Democrat leader, went to see David Miliband, who was then Community Secretary, I think his first cabinet post, with a proposition. A proposition for economic devolution to Greater Manchester to be supported by a new statutory body covering Greater Manchester, but not a statutory body, not a return to the old County Council, a new statutory body which would effectively be owned, it would be a cooperative body between the 10 districts in Greater Manchester. And we believed, even though we had a very successful voluntary association, that we needed a statutory body because we couldn't see how government could devolve powers to us if we had a structure which meant any partner at any time would say, we've had enough now, we're not going to play anymore. We believe that we needed a statutory body to underpin devolution. We backed that up a couple of years later with the Manchester Independent Economic Review, which created an incredible evidence base that basically showed what was wrong with our economy, what we needed to do about it, and the tools we needed in order to be able to do that. And it was an evidence base that was sufficiently strong that we didn't have to argue with government, particularly we didn't have to argue with Treasury about what the evidence base was. It was through that that we really were able to sign our first devolution deal. History will probably record that we did our devolution deal with George Osborne in 2014. Actually, our first devolution deal was signed with Liam Byrne, who was Chief Secretary of the Treasury, in 2009. Only one part of that devolution deal got implemented, and that was legislation which I think John Healy was largely responsible for, that allowed us to establish a combined authority. Again, to a certain extent, we got lucky. If we were trying to do a combined authority now, we'd probably find, bear in mind this was the first combined authority, if we were trying to do the first combined authority now, we probably wouldn't be able to do it. Because the order for the combined authority was laid whilst we still had a Labour government, but it had to be approved by the coalition government. How we struck lucky at that time, in Greater Manchester, 10 councils, 5 Labour, 2 Conservative, 3 Liberal Democrat, and the Liberal Democrats and Conservative councils went to their government and said, we want a combined authority. I think if we did not have those, we probably would not have got a combined authority, although it's interesting that later that year at a Conservative Party conference in Manchester, when I had the great joy of sharing a platform with Mr. Pickles, for those who remember him, he was asked by some audience largely Conservative councillors what he thought the future of local government was. And Pickles said, I think we might be seeing that now in Manchester. He actually, I think, bought what combined authorities were all about. When the coalition came into government, they didn't throw all of those plans out. And you can see a direct link, particularly to city deals, that were announced fairly early on. It's a direct continuation of work that we've done with Treasury before the election, because some of the same people were still in place and were still supporting that agenda. And so we were able to make a slow move towards devolution with, from 2011, of course, that that combined authority in place, that new statutory body in place. At the same time, our thinking developed. Most of the thinking in the noughties have been around devolution purely for economic purposes. It's all about growth. But we've developed an understanding in the early part of this decade that we needed to do more of this, that we needed to start delivering public services in a completely different sort of way. So when we got into the growth fund, I think Greater Manchester was the only place that put forward a proposal that was not just about growth, it was about growth and reform, that we've changed the way that we operated public services. And when, in 2014, we got to a devolution deal, it was as much about reform as it was about economic growth. 2014 is a year where lots happened. David Higgins published his first report into High Speed 2, where he argued not only was High Speed 2 essential to the long-term future of the UK, to maximise benefit, that we also needed to improve transport links into the major nodes on the High Speed 2, and in particular, we needed to improve TransPennine rail links. And that led to the northern core cities drafting a report, One North. A Treasury official got a sneak preview of that One North report, which was very much based on work done actually under the Northern Way, a Labour government initiative in 2008. But from that sneak preview, the One North report argued for improved Trans-Pennine links, in particular a new railway line between Manchester and Leeds, Manchester and Sheffield, from Liverpool all the way across to Hull, but also citing the Rhine-Ruhr area, the Randstad in the Netherlands, basically made the argument that a better connector north of England would have an economic impact far greater than all these cities and towns being treated separately. And that translated to two things, Northern Powerhouse and High Speed 3. We never called it High Speed 3 in the North, by the way. We always called it Northern Powerhouse Rail. But George Osborne called it High Speed 3. As far as we were concerned, he could call it what he liked, as long as at some point we're going to get some money for it. The name was not a big thing. But Northern Powerhouse, actually, it wasn't a gimmick. The economics that underpin it, the idea of a number of cities that actually are medium-sized but close together, being able to have the impact of being a large city by being better connected, it is absolutely real, but we have to have the transport to be able to deliver it. And the final bit of, the other bit in George Osborne's speech that he made in Manchester when he talked about Northern Powerhouse, was he said that he wanted all of our cities to have London-style mayors. One of the little jobs I had that summer was to persuade him of the reasons why we should not have a London-style mayor, and if we were going to have a mayor at all, it had to be a Manchester-style mayor. I'm delighted. Really, for George, you said that I don't care what sort of mayor you have, as long as you have a mayor. That's the only given. So, and it's an important thing is that combined authorities, the mayoral combined authority, the model that we've got in Greater Manchester is a model we designed. It was designed by us, for us, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's worked relatively effectively. November 2014, devolution deal. It is still by some way the deepest, widest devolution deal, to the extent to which when Sadiq Khan became Mayor of London, his first request to Sajid Javid, who was then Secretary of State CLG, was, can I have the same powers as Manchester, please? Which I think London is slowly working towards, but isn't there yet. What's particularly striking, of course, about the Manchester devolution deal, health and social care, that most of the decisions about a £6 billion a year budget are being made in Manchester now, not in Whitehall, which is where decisions were being made previously. The other probably big aspect is that bus franchising, something that London's always had, now becomes within the remit of the mayoral combined authority. And actually, there is a similarity with London. Manchester, Greater Manchester, is now, with London, the only two places that do not have a police and crime commissioner, in that our mayor is the police and crime commissioner as well. That Devo Manc really takes us to where we are now. So I started off with a brief description of what Manchester was like in 1979 and the early 80s. A little bit of what it's like now, and I'm going to use a few symbols that loosely represent a picture of Manchester. It's clearly the centre in particular is physically transformed. A few weeks ago I was out at the University of Salford with the Dean of the School of the Built Environment, and they occupy the seventh floor of the Maxwell Building, which looks out over Manchester city centre. And Professor Hisham Elkadi is the Dean of the School of the Built Environment there, so this must be a reliable source, I believe him anyway. So there are more cranes over Manchester now than any other city in Europe except London. That's the scale of the development that's taking place within the city. Back in the mid-80s, when Wimpy built St. John's Gardens, they couldn't sell it. By the end of that decade, there were 500 people living in Manchester city centre. There are now around 35,000 people living in Manchester city centre, and that will grow probably by 20,000 in the next decade. Complete transformation. It is now a place where people live, and if you went back 20 years, if people lived there, it tends to be 2 or 3 years, then you want family or something, move out to the suburbs. Now people don't want to move out to the suburbs. They still want to have families and stuff, but they want to stay. They want to maintain that urban lifestyle. It has become a place that people want to live in. The city of Manchester's population itself, since 2001, has increased by 35%. A city that was dying in the 80s, its population continued to decline until about 1996-7, when it plateaued at the bottom, got down to about 400,000, it's now about 560,000, and probably in the next 5 years it will top 600,000. It's going back to what it was in its heyday. It's a younger city. Bradford will tell you that they're the youngest city in the UK. I will tell you that Manchester's the youngest city in the UK, and I'll also tell you we're both right. It's different definitions of Bradford have more young people of school age. We have the youngest average age of our population. So it's a younger city, and they're doing different things. If you look at commercial space in the city now, for most of the last decade, the biggest tenants of space have been financial and professional services. That's true in most cities. For the last year, the biggest taker of space was tech. But a third of all commercial space was taken by tech companies, 29% by value, and that trend is continuing. The sort of business that's operating within the city centre is changing just as our economy is changing. Those are indicators of a city that was a failure that is now a success, a city that 20 years ago people didn't want to live in. Even 15 years ago, in terms of social housing, if you went to the council house in Manchester, you would have had a choice of you could have lived anywhere pretty much because there were so many empty houses. We don't have any empty houses anymore, pretty much anywhere in the city. The void rate goes something from 2% in Withenshaw to about 4% in the city centre. 4% means it's full. Turnover accounts for that almost entirely. And so you probably think we're all really very, very happy in Manchester now because it's going so well. Well, no, there are a few buts around this. The Economic Inclusion Audit Unit at the University of Manchester will still be able to tell you that if the district's in Greater Manchester, the city of Manchester is still the least inclusive. Those problems of deprivation that were created, particularly by that recession of the 80s, we have not sorted all those problems out yet. We're nowhere near sorting those problems out. So rebuilding a city, it takes a long time. Disaster happens overnight, rebuilding takes a long, long time. We're still in the process of rebuilding. Economically, the southern half of the city region, Manchester, Trafford, Stockport, Salford, doing really, really well. The northern half is not doing well at all. So we have real challenges to address over the next period of time. But what I do believe we have done through the establishment of the combined authority for what we've been able to do through devolution, still not enough devolution, by the way, is now at least to a certain extent we do have the tools to start address those issues in every part of the conurbation, and over the next decade we'll continue to do that. And I would hope that perhaps in 10 to 15 years that somebody will be able to come back to a gathering such as this, and what I'm able to say about Manchester City Centre, we'll be able to say about Oldham, we'll be able to say about Rochdale, we'll be able to say about all the towns within our conurbation. So, bit of success, but a long, long way to go. Thank you very much.
So many things covered, so many different aspects covered in terms of what it makes to make a great city and how to think about that renaissance and revival. So we've got some time for questions. If you could raise your hand, there's a mic that will come round. Just say who you are, take a couple, and then I'll get Richard to reply. So take the lady right at the back, the gentleman right in the corner, and the gentleman down here. So we'll take the first three and then we'll go from there. So yep, just say who you are.
Hi, my name's Bethany. Thanks for that talk, it was very interesting. I'm from Manchester myself, and I often think it's strange how transport between the cities takes so long. And given that we've got Transport for the North set up at the moment, I was just wondering, do you think Manchester and the rest of the Northern Powerhouse is closer to getting a decent transport system? I know everyone hopes for it, so.
Okay. Are we any closer to the ambition of better connecting our places within and between? I think it's partly the issue. So, yeah, gentlemen at the back there.
Hello, Sir Richard. James Stevens from the Homeland Federation. You'll be aware of what James Brokenshire has said about the proposal from One Yorkshire Deal, basically he's stuck to. Do you have, I'm interested in your perspective on that, do you think the One Yorkshire proposal was always a non-goer because it was too big, too diffuse, or do you think that kind of runs counter to, I think, your idea that it should be
we check that mic is on? That was quite quiet, I could hear it, but just check if it's on, if the light is on. And the gentleman, you've got one? Yeah, go for it.
Brett of Builders Merchants Federation. Sincerely, we'd like to thank your club for supplying half a dozen lads who paid in red and white over in Russia this last month. My question is, in 2 months' time, it'll be the party political conference season. In 2 months after that, it will be the budget. What one thing do you and Manchester want as a Christmas present between now and the end of the year, please?
Right, you've been scribbling as well. So are we any closer to getting the transport system that you described? What do you really think about One Yorkshire? And what's the one thing that you could get from the government between now and the end of the year?
Okay, I'll take the Christmas present first, if I can. It would be for us to have full devolution of post-18 skills and apprenticeships to Greater Manchester, because that would probably be the biggest single thing that we could do relatively quickly to improve productivity in our economy. And to be equally succinct about One Yorkshire, as far as I'm concerned, it's substituting romantic nostalgia for economic reality. It is absolute nonsense idea. Hull should be linked with the other side of the Humber. Leeds, West Yorkshire, that urban conurbation should be a mayoral combined authority, as in Sheffield. And the economic needs of the rural hinterland, whilst they are clearly connected, they serve each other, need to be managed in a completely different way. So I'd say that for Yorkshire, there actually ought to be four combined authorities, not one. And the last question, are we any closer to the transport links we want, Bethany? yes. Again, by the North of England working together, and genuinely speaking with one voice, which we've now been doing probably since about 2013, we've got specifications for the Northern Rail franchises, which were a vast improvement on what we had previously. So once Network Rail managed to do some engineering work, so we've got some tracks for things to run on, that by 2019, Pacers will disappear. We will have lots and lots of new trains, there will be longer trains, there will be more frequent trains. So we are going to get some short-term improvements. In terms of, however, what we need in order to get Northern Pass, we're quite a long way off that. The improvements we need now to Manchester Leeds seem to be slipping back in time, because what you do need some short-term improvements to that, and we could do short-term improvements to that. Northern Powerhouse Rail, which is essential to the long-term future, that's going to be the early 2030s by the time we get that. So it's a mixed picture, really. We are going to get some short-term benefits, but it's a long time off to get what we really need.
Okay, very good. So we'll take some more. We'll take one here to the front. Straight to the front. Let's take the, start there, then there, and then gentleman there. Just say who you are.
My name is David Lai. I'm a management consultant, Boohiss, but I'm interested in housing in particular, and in particular some work that the National Housing Federation is doing, thinking about the future of housing, in particular the future of housing associations. Underpinning your history was 1979 and the 1980s depression and the social and economic problems that still persist in Manchester. And I wonder what your thoughts are on what housing associations can be doing to help address those social and economic problems, and whether there's more that they ought to be doing than they actually are doing.
Okay, very good. Gentleman here, pass it to Mark Long. So you are.
Thank you, Mark Pendleton from Portsmouth City Council. Brilliant, just brilliant talk, really, really enjoyed it. Great, all the way back and so on. But there were a couple of things you didn't talk about, which I thought was interesting. Government Office for the Northwest and European funding. Because I was working in the Northwest in some of the periods you were talking about, and I was just thinking how influential for Manchester Government Office of the Northwest and European funding, particularly after the bomb. You didn't mention that. The other one is Lord Smith, and I just always felt that the fact you had Wigan and you had a leader of Wigan who kind of fronted AGMA, and so it wasn't about Manchester, it was about that greater picture, and he was very influential, I think, in kind of doing that. And those are the two things I thought you didn't mention. I was wondering why you didn't.
Okay, time constraints. Apart from that, if there's more to it than that, we'll let him answer. If it's simply time constraints, not anybody else start going down there, and what about?
Defos has been involved in development for the government and city authorities. Firstly, I'd like to mention Mr. Armitt's piece in the Evening Standard tonight, where he talked about the European Investment Bank, which builds on our colleague's observation over there, and the sums of money involved and the sorts of activity you want to create in the future. What's your alternative after Brexit? A tough question, don't get to answer that. And really, I am so pleased to see the fact that you've kept all the great planners, negotiators, strategists, and community engagers that have allowed you to turn Manchester into a great city over a period of 20 years around. What is your human resource management strategy for keeping these great people with you in the next 10 years, when every city in the UK and Europe might want them?
Yeah, I've got those, yes. Housing future, the role of housing associations, in terms of our housing needs, that we need everything in Manchester. We need everything from high-value executive housing and Gary Neville's going to build us some of that, I'm delighted to say. It's all right, Gary Neville used to come in my office and he had to look at a picture of the Etihad Stadium every time he came in. And I did have the opportunity to tell him that he gave me one of my favourite football moments, which was the last Derby game played at Main Road, where Gary Neville basically gave the ball to Sean Goethe to score the winner. So that's a complete aside from the answer. But clearly, the constraints on rent have made it more difficult for housing associations to deliver what they need to deliver, but they have a crucial role as a partner in delivering genuinely affordable housing. And by genuinely affordable housing, I don't mean something that's at 80% of market rent. It's something that is based on the salaries that people are earning and what they can afford. And of course, for some families, that means it has to be a rent that is wholly coverable from by housing benefit. They also have a particular role that there is quite a large range of specialist housing that's required. So I'll give one example of that. We've been working with five housing associations basically to buy large houses for rehousing of homeless families, where there is a shortage of large family accommodation. There are a whole range of other areas where housing associations have an essential role to play. I think, though, around housing, and again, this is the role of housing associations, what we don't want is people who just build houses. I could spend hours on what's wrong with volume house builders, but essentially what's wrong with them is that they just build houses and clear off. They don't make places, and we have to be making places. And I think housing associations have a real role to play in placemaking. Only two things I didn't mention. So there are probably hundreds of things I didn't mention. But there's something that's talking to Andrew beforehand, and one of the things I said to Andrew is that the role of Peter Smith is often underappreciated for what he did in holding Greater Manchester together through this period of time, and he did play a really, really important role, and very happy to acknowledge that role. In terms of European funding, it's been important because European funding is still the only source of long-term funding that we can try and at least try and plan for 6 years. And as we move towards shared prosperity, if it does operate in a very similar way, I think that's going to be a significant problem for particularly for urban areas. Go northwest. I'll be less enthusiastic about, because you had to go and clear everything in London. They had no devolved power either. So basically, they might keep a few of the functions turning over, but they didn't really have any decision-making power. And so, yeah, they were supported, they were often supported, but I don't think they ever worked in the way that, again, Michael Heseltine thought they were going to work or wanted them to work. The two questions, the European Investment Bank and post-Brexit, partially answer the question, is that what we have to do is to find other sources of long-term finance in order to be able to do what we need to. When I was talking about what we need to do in town centres like Oldham and Rochdale, the term we use in Manchester now is we need patient equity, not grants, but we need money that we can invest and not expect a return for maybe 10, 15 years, and we need sources for that. In order to do the sort of local transport investment we need, we believe in Greater Manchester, we need £15 billion between now and 2040 just to invest in local transport, never mind the intercity transport. We need to find new ways. Our view is we ought to be able to do it, a lot of that money raised through basically capturing increases in land value. We've been talking to Treasury about that. They're not enthusiastic because it's complicated, but they either have to give us new tools to raise money or they need to give us the money. It's got to be one or the other in order to do that sort of investment. And in terms of human resources, managed to keep a chief executive for 18 years, which is a long term in time in local government. But this is somebody who was born in North Manchester, went to school in North Manchester, and still lives in North Manchester. This is somebody with Manchester written right through the middle of them. And I guess that's what we have to do. We've got a number of other senior officers who've been with us for a very long time. Just like anybody else who's going to move to Manchester, they've got to want to be in Manchester. It's got to be a place that they want to be. So the place we're trying to create applies just as much to our staff as it does to anybody else, and that's what we're trying to do.
We'll take a couple more. I have a question. Get your thoughts on the future for the urban agenda and devolution, whether we have the continuation of the current government, or if we had a Labour government, your thoughts on likelihood of the urban agenda remaining or being something that they would be committed to. But so that's my question to you. Take one there. Yeah. So just keep your hand up until the mic gets to you, so my colleague can help. Just so who you are.
I'm Will Lord. I work in the city's local growth unit, including on the Greater Manchester local industrial strategy. One kind of institution you often hear a lot about in the stories of big city regeneration are universities. I'd be interested to know what role have Manchester's universities played in the city's success.
Okay, university role in city success, and then, yep.
Chris Winter, I work for the Mayor of London. What's your recipe for political survival? I mean, 30 years, that's amazing. And how critical has that stability been for the growth of the city? Because politics is a tough business. How have you survived? How critical a factor is it? Because I think it's pretty important.
Okay. Universities, how important? How have you lasted as long as you have?
Future of the urban agenda.
And the urban agenda.
spent a big chunk of the last decade having to get actually get urban on the agenda, never mind anything else, get cities on the agenda. Cities are on the agenda. In this decade, City Growth Commission in particular played a really big role. Your organisation clearly, the only one, you're all about cities, it plays a role. We will almost certainly have to rerun these arguments in the next decade as well. And in a post-Brexit world, there is clearly an emphasis on those places that are described as the places left behind. And actually, these are where the old industries have gone and have not been replaced with anything that has the same value. So even if people are in work, they don't value it in the same way. And a lot of their social infrastructure was around their places of work as well. A lot of that's been destroyed as well. So I think, go back to where one of the points I talked about in 1999 about city regions. That report talked about cities and their hinterland. What cities are going to have to do, as well as demonstrating that they are drivers of economic growth, we're also going to have to demonstrate our relevance to that hinterland, how that we are important to their long-term future as well. And I think that's probably the new argument that we really need to be strong on going forward. One of the many things I missed out, and I had in at one point, but I overran my time anyway, but 2004 got missed out. What happened in 2004 is that you missed, and the University, Victoria University of Manchester merged. That's something that I've campaigned and lobbied for actually a large number of years to get the two universities to merge. And the basis of that, this is the simple basis, is that I thought, and as did a few other people, it would be really good if Manchester had a world-class research university. Now, both of them thought they were world-class research universities, but neither of them actually were. Actually, most universities think they are, most of them aren't. But by merging, effectively what it did, it created a lot of efficiencies, but also a critical mass in world-leading research that put it in, that gave it the potential to be a world-class university. And I think it's still, depending on which table you look at, it's in top 50 in all of them, which is they're harder tables to get into nowadays because of Chinese universities, Indian universities and so on are all getting very, very good. The competition is East European universities. The competition is getting tougher, but by creating the University of Manchester as it is now, it was a very, very important part in the economic success of Manchester. Yesterday we announced a European company, Kyogen, concentrating their molecular diagnostics and biomarker research in Manchester. That wouldn't have happened if we'd not had the merger of the universities. Graphene, National Graphene Institute, this Henry Royce Institute for Advanced Materials, wouldn't have happened without the merger of the universities. I did mention the talk, University of Salford, and certainly, again, all three of our major universities, over a quarter of all the health professionals in this country are trained in those three universities. So it's very, very significant in the health field. And there are 165,000 people employed in Greater Manchester in health and social care. It's a very big economic factor. So universities are really, really important. Peter Houston, is it Peter Houston? Got my names wrong. Planner, LSE, help me. Came from Blackpool, formed Peter Hall, thank you. You know. Peter Hall said that you only need two things for economic growth, an airport and a university. And he's being oversimple, of course, but actually that's knowledge and infrastructure are what you need. I didn't mention the airport either. The airport's been, Manchester Airport's been pretty important to how we've got on. Recipe for political survival, win elections. It's really, really easy. As I keep saying, the only skills I need to be leader of Manchester City Council are to win more votes than somebody else. That's it. How do you win elections? You work hard, you stay in touch, you stay in touch. Don't take your electorate for granted. I've just been re-elected for another four years. took 73% of the vote in that that election. You do that by working hard. That's it. But ultimately, political survival, winning elections.
But you think the other bit was the stability element and the significance of that in being able to see, you know, some of the things you were saying came through in 96 and you've been able to see them through over 22 years. Does that matter?
It can do. Stability can actually lead to sterility as well.
Yeah.
There are lots of places which have had stable leadership over a long period of time, which is guaranteed that absolutely nothing has happened. Stability in itself is not sufficient. I think there is an attitudinal thing that, and this was true of both myself and Howard Bernstein when he was chief executive. It's why it's very odd for me to be doing retrospective, really, because basically what's done is done. What matters is what's next. And indeed, as my second ex-wife said, the problem with us was that she lived in the present and I lived in the future.
So on that note, I could possibly go on around a question would never be able to follow. I said at the start that the series is about asking those that make and shape our cities to give us their longer view of what happens and how change happens. And I think we've had a fantastic lecture from Sir Richard this evening, precisely showing us the mix of things that happen in places and how you take advantage of opportunities and always look to the future whilst never forgetting the past. So please join me with Sir Richard for a fantastic